What's the future of how we understand the past? I wonder if you've done a bit of history research in your own family, maybe into your area or the house that you live in. What have you learned doing it? 0438 922936. And what makes the difference between a pro historian and an amateur? Dr. Nick Brody is an author of many highly recognised books and an historian. And Kristen Harmon is a senior lecturer in history at UTAS. Hi, Nick. Hi, Kristen.
G'day, Rick. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey, Kristen, what's the difference between like an amateur historian and a professional historian? Is there a group you join?
Well, there are actually groups you can join, but usually people that become professional historians and academic historians have been trained by doing university degrees and often have a PhD in history.
And so that's kind of the marker. And like you've both published books about history. Is publishing really important in terms of being recognised?
Absolutely.
If you don't get your work out there, who knows what you've done?
And is it about getting it published by recognised publishing houses that makes the difference? Or what about self-publishing in history?
My writing career really started with self-publishing history, so that's perfectly acceptable, normal route to getting your work out there.
How is history not keeping up, do you think, with contemporary times now?
I think that history is a little bit stuffy. You know, historians are often depicted as wearing patches on their sleeves and stuck in the 1950s. And in many ways, the whole discipline sort of is. It's still ground in a world where historians largely write journal articles for other historians about opaque topics. You know, some people move out into the public and are good at getting it out there, but there's still quite a lot who really just speak to an in-club.
And in terms of teaching history, I mean, it used to be that there was an authoritative, definitive history, Kristen, and now, of course, we talk about perspectives. How is something authoritative in history? How is it validated?
Yeah, sure. Look, that's a really good question, Rick. So, really, there's a couple of things I'd like to say in response to it. So, at the moment, to go back to the idea about history perhaps being stuffy, it certainly can be the case. At the moment, we're at the start of a new teaching semester, so as well as giving students the kind of more traditional things like, you know, published journal articles and so forth, we're also having a podcast and the conversation article each week. So I think that's bringing things up into the 21st century. But what we also do is, with the students, have a look at, you know, who's written the history that they're reading, what sort of argument are they making, what's their key points, what evidence are they drawing on, and are we convinced by the ways in which they've used that evidence? So we actually have to really engage our critical faculties and drill right down to see what's sitting behind that history, to see whether, in fact, you know, we think it has legs.
So we need to do more work, I guess you're saying, to work out whether someone's authoritative or not ourselves, Nick, which raises the question, Nick, about cancel culture.
Yep.
You know, where you'll get someone, like a group of people on Twitter, stacking on to someone to going, right, well, we're just cancelling you because your views are not appropriate to what we believe is right now. Is that sort of the process of history in the making?
Sometimes, yeah. So there's different elements to that which I find really fascinating. One is the way that whole cancel culture process can snowball so quickly. Sometimes it's based on good history. Sometimes, as in the case of, you know, the statue in Bristol, there's quite a wealth of material and there's been an agenda about the problematic version of history that these people are criticising. Other times, however, they can kind of just as easily run away with a just as problematic, although politically different version of history. So sometimes it's politics, sometimes it's good history, and really it's up to everybody to get involved and really understand what's behind that all the time. And as we're moving into a digital world where there's resources at our fingertips, we can actually check primary sources really quickly and easily, very often. So we shouldn't always rely on people just because we like their argument. We should actually assess their evidence.
Quite often, though, Kristen, and I've had this experience of being in an argument with someone who said, but we can't change these things because that's the end of history. We can't take down the statues. We can't do that because that's ending history.
Yeah, I think the, well, things like taking down statues are in fact history in the making, and in a few years, well, in fact already we've seen publications come out about it, you know, in the popular media, but in a few years we'll see academic articles starting to appear because of the lag time and being published on that very transition. And I think rather than the end of history per se, things like the tearing down of the statues is the end of a certain type of history, you know, a celebratory history where we celebrate people, and often men, who have in fact done some very nasty things in the past. So it's people reacting to that kind of celebratory culture that had those people up on pedestals that we no longer think they deserve to be on.
Literally on pedestals. I mean, no one complained when Saddam Hussein statues were being toppled. That was celebrated in the West, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we kind of look at that in terms of, you know, getting bogged down in these arguments with people over the weekend, as we may well be. How do you present evidence to someone when they don't listen? Do you know what I mean? I don't know if you've had this problem, Nick, but you can have like all the best evidence in the world and people go, well, I just don't agree.
Yeah, I know. I have that all the time. I publish on something and I can lay out the evidence and then somebody will write to me or talk to me and just say, well, I just don't quite believe that. And really, there's almost nothing you can do except to just keep patiently putting the evidence out there. I also like the tactic of subtly or at least bluntly sometimes trying to undermine their argument. But that, I mean, that's how you really spiral into big arguments. But sometimes positive evidence is sometimes hard for people to take. Like when you present a story by showing this is the evidence and you build it up. Mm. But at other times, if you can find clear evidence that cuts across their version, then that can be a much more powerful tool. And I'm thinking here of the way that there's a lot of discussion about John Batman. He was a very celebrated figure in Australian history, major settler in Tasmania, founder of Melbourne. Obviously, statues went up, you know, electorates were named after him. But once you start presenting those words where in his own handwriting he describes killing Aboriginal people who are his prisoners, then that really cuts across that whole narrative quite nicely. You know, just that one event shows that the celebratory version is obviously problematic and it's not the full version.
And Kristen, I guess in that example, there are hard facts in history, or is everything a perspective?
Well, a mix of the both, I think, Rick. So there's definitely hard facts, and there, you know, I'm thinking back quite a long time now to the history wars at their height in Australia, where we had Keith Windschuttle writing about Van Diemen's Land, Tasmania, and sort of rubbishing other historians' views of what happened here in the wars. At the same time, talking about how his next volume would be on New South Wales, which I thought would be mighty interesting, and I note he never wrote that because I'd worked through those archives myself. And in Governor Lachlan Macquarie's own handwriting, he's instructing his soldiers, his crack regiment, to go out, get Aboriginal prisoners, to hang them from the trees, to chain them two by two, to make examples of them, you know. So once you see this sort of thing in colonial governors' own handwriting, those sorts of facts are indisputable. But look, history really is a series of ongoing arguments, if you like. More information can emerge. You know, maybe someone's got a document hidden in the attic somewhere, or there's, you know, new evidence comes to light all the time. Our own ways of thinking change, so that influences the way we see the past. How we see the past today is different from the way people did in the 1960s and so on.
And, like, we're nearly out of time, which is such a shame, because I still want to talk about the whole digital aspect of history, which, are we very good at being historians of people's Twitter feeds, of their Snapchat accounts?
Oh, so that's going to be a really, really hard one. I was only talking about that yesterday. We have the problem that we're a society that produces a wealth of documentation, but it's so ephemeral. Whether it's going to survive long enough for historians to gestate it is really the big question, and I suspect not. They'll be overwhelmed with material if it does.
Because a lot of lives, like, if you can get the data, you could know pretty much everywhere they've been for a biography.
Well, I do that all the time. I love looking at my Google trackings and see where I go around Hobart.
Just Googling yourself.
Yeah.
I don't want anyone else when I'm without you. I Google myself. Kristen, what do you think in terms of the future of teaching history and learning history? How are we going to have to become better data historians and digital historians?
Yeah, look, I think it's changing already. So one of the things I'm doing and experimenting with this teaching semester, which has just kicked off, is having a digital showcase each week. So we're actually exploring each week one of the rich digital resources that's been created, either as a tool for historians to mine or sometimes as the outcome of a large research project. So different, entirely different one each week, heaps to choose from. And it is changing our approaches. I think we're really in a transition phase at the moment, which is quite exciting. And the histories of the future are going to be quite different.
You sound like such a fun teacher. Thanks for talking with me this morning. It's great to chat to you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Rick.